Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Lori Cox Hahn and Caroline Heldman, who are editors of Madam President? Gender and Politics on the Road to the White House. This was published in 2020 by Lynn Reiner Press. And full disclosure, I have a co-authored chapter in this book, but we are going to talk about the book as a whole and not my chapter. And I'd like to welcome Caroline and Lori to the podcast and ask them to tell us a little bit about this book and how they came to this project and about themselves as well. Hi, Caroline. Hi, Lori. Welcome to the New Books Podcast.
Hello. Thank you, Lily.
Thanks for having us on.
Well, I guess I'll start. Pleasure. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I'll start and give you a little bit of background on not just this book, but the work that Caroline and I have been doing on this topic for quite some time. I'm basically interested in the topic of electing a woman president really since graduate school. So it's been since the late 1990s. The very first time Caroline and I met, it was at a conference, the Western Political Science Association, and I'm not sure I remember the year, but I think it was 2005. And our very first conversation was about, you know, the idea that so many people had already decided that basically Hillary Clinton was going to be the first woman president. It was going to happen in 2008. And we both just thought that sounded a little bit too simplistic and missing a lot of the things that would happen along the way. So we started talking about putting together an edited volume. And the first one with Lynn Reiner was called Rethinking Madam President, published in 2007, I think. And so we decided that we wanted to come back to that topic after Hillary Clinton lost the presidency in 2016. And we thought it was a really good time to take a look at all of the issues that we included in the book, all of the different facets that go into, you know, presidential election and what had improved and what had not improved at that point for women seeking the White House. And so that was really kind of the backstory of how we got this started a few years ago.
And just to follow up on that, we, both of us, were very much in agreement that it was too optimistic. We believe that the reason that fellow political scientists were being so optimistic is that they simply were unaware of the research on the issue. And there wasn't much done. I will say that our 2005 piece on Elizabeth Dole around the 2000 election, she brought only a skirt. That piece, I think, was a first systematic analysis of media coverage using a content analysis. But Khan and others for, you know, the better part of two decades had been writing about the barriers to women running for the presidency. And I think even today, there's not a lot of knowledge in the field and certainly not outside of the field that prior to Hillary Clinton, 12 women had made very serious bids, national bids, party nominees, that sort of thing, national press attention, and their candidacies had gone nowhere. And in fact, Elizabeth Dole was the first female candidate for the presidency who was treated like a legitimate candidate by the press. And even she was really beaten up with negative coverage and coverage that focused on her dress and appearance. And so this history generally wasn't known. And I think Lori and I have really dedicated ourselves to making sure that, you know, that we continue to write on this, because so few people tend to really understand the barriers to a woman getting this position.
And of course, I am a student of your work because it is excellent. And as you note, it's sort of in this area of women in politics, which I also do my own work on. But I wanted to ask you specifically about this book, the follow-up to the Rethinking Madam President, because this one has a question mark in the title. And as you noted, you know, you said that you thought your colleagues were too optimistic. And so in a lot of ways, we have this question of what are the barriers? What is the research that you pulled together in this volume that came out in 2020, but, you know, sort of started to get pulled together after the election, where Hillary Clinton was the nominee, but lost the general election. What did you find as you were recruiting chapters and thinking about, you know, what the research should look like?
Well, I think that one of the issues I really wanted to address with this new volume was just the fact that this was the post-Hillary Clinton era, because so much attention had been focused on her up to that point. And I think that there was an assumption, especially that she would win, obviously, especially in 2016 against Donald Trump. And so then we could start looking at, what does it mean to have the first woman president? And so the fact that she lost still suggested there was maybe some work to be done, and that maybe if you looked past this just one candidate, you could see some of the more complex, nuanced issues out there that women candidates face. So I really wanted, and I know, you know, Caroline and I together, when we talked through why we wanted to do this book, we really wanted to reassess and say, okay, now what? And I think a lot of the chapters really looked past the, you know, both the good and bad that came from Hillary Clinton's two presidential campaigns, and gave us a sense of, okay, here are the issues where we really need to work moving forward.
And Lily, your chapter with Linda Beale, I think, was a relatively new contribution in terms of the field, right? It's something that you've written on extensively, and Lori and I have used your work, where you talk about the fact that seeing a Black male president in numerous TV shows and films over the years normalize that, and that we were behind in terms of seeing that normalized for women, but really focusing on the influence of pop culture and how that has just simply made it more, you know, in the minds of many voters, more acceptable to have a woman running for that office and in the White House. And also, you know, we used to, prior to Donald Trump, we used to have to convince folks that masculinity was a really big part of running for the presidency and holding the office, and that leadership was very masculinized. And I think that Meredith Conroy's chapter on masculinity in the presidency landed much more directly, because we had this kind of obvious example in front of us where we've never had such a hyper-masculine contest, right? Where you actually have, you know, hand size coming up in a presidential debate. So that was far more obvious than in previous years. And then I contributed a chapter specifically on the women's movement and, you know, the largest single day protest in U.S. history, the day after Donald Trump's inauguration, and what role his presidency and hypermasculinity played in really mobilizing women and some men in the form of a new social movement, and how sexual violence played into that and the Me Too movement. So I think the social political context of the 2016 election really was foreshadowed what was coming in the 2020 election.
And I wanted to ask a little bit about the chapter that you wrote, Caroline, in terms of thinking not only about the women's movement and the marches that sort of followed the election of Donald Trump, but can you talk a little bit about the research that you looked at and what you concluded in terms of the role of something like the Me Too movement that sort of spun through this entire period where we have this hyper-masculine president who's also in front of our faces every single day on Twitter or in the media. And then we start to have this cavalcade of cases of high profile men who are losing their jobs and positions because of people who have finally sort of said, I can't take it anymore. Can you talk a little bit about that, how that fits into, you know, sort of thinking about electing a woman president, or in the most recent case, perhaps a woman vice president?
Certainly. So Donald Trump has given us some gifts, right? This is how I like to see them, that he has actually made. So we know that America is a profoundly racist country with high levels of racial resentment and white supremacy, and he has actually brought that to the surface. And so we can address it, and however painful that may be. So I'm looking, you know, the silver lining here, but I would argue the same thing is happening with sexual violence and sexism, that he, I think, especially young women thought that we had come much further than we had in terms of gender roles and gender respect. And Donald Trump's presidency made it very clear that you could have 23 allegations of sexual violence, and it didn't matter. You could be elected to the highest office in the land. And in fact, that a certain, you know, number of people in the population would, it elevated his status for them. It was a way for him to assert his masculinity, these allegations of sexual violence. And so I write about how, you know, the Me Too movement culminated all at the same time. And I don't think that's happenstance. I think it had a lot to do with people kind of opening their eyes to what was right in front of them, which is the fact that, you know, we live in a rape culture where we don't take rape seriously as a crime. It's the only crime where we put the victim on trial. And how does this play into ideas about what it means to be a real man who has a lot of sexual conquests? How did that make how did that play into Trump's masculine bravado? And why is it that we're still defining manhood in terms in implied terms of sexual violence. And so, you know, Donald Trump's presidency really gave us a front row seat to just how overt sexism can be. But again, I think it's just drawing out things that are already there. It's just making them more obvious.
And so in terms of the research in general that came through in the book, I mean, as you noted, I did some work with Linda Beale on popular culture in the presidency, and Meredith Conroy, who also has an excellent book on masculinity and the presidency, also talks about that on the campaign trail. I was wondering, in terms of the chapters as they were coming in and as you're reading them, because you're also both scholars of this, deep scholars of this, and you've done so much work yourselves and you've read so widely, what was surprising in terms of the research that people were finding conclusions that you thought, oh, that's not what I expected, or, oh, that's exactly what I expected?
Yeah, I'll address that a little bit. You know, we really wanted to, just like with the first book, but especially with this one, we really wanted to do a state of things in terms of all of the different components, not only of an individual candidate and her campaign running for president, but how were women doing overall across the board politically. So, you know, we were looking at issues of media, pop culture, you know, representation in the executive branch, policy issues, political parties, foreign policy, money, you know, Victoria Farrar Myers' chapter on money, which was an update for her from the previous Rethinking Madam President volume. I think her research showed, and I think some of us who pay attention to this kind of sense that's where it was going, is that money wasn't really the factor that I think 20, 25 years ago people thought it would be for women candidates. I mean, we've assumed, or falsely assumed, I think, for a long time, that women couldn't fundraise as well as men in politics. Well, now we know that's not true. And in some cases, women are, you know, even better at fundraising than male colleagues. And so, you know, the data in Victoria's chapter really showed that we really had made progress with this. And that wasn't the thing that was stopping women from getting elected to you know, higher office. And I'll just thrown to that my chapter in the book, the introductory chapter, really took the macro view. So wanted to really say, okay, what really is the state of things right now? And so I also addressed the issue of, you know, we need to elect a woman president, woman vice president also, because that will really, you know, change things up in terms of finally breaking through that one of those last gender barriers. And so I think that, you know, now that we do have a woman president, we can learn a lot about her campaign and how she got to that point and what that means for women in political leadership positions moving forward.
And Laura, you just, a Freudian slip there, you just referred to Kamala Harris as president. So,
oh, did I? Oh,
good on you. And I would just, I would build on that with, you know, Brian Frederick, Laurel Elder, and Barbara Burrell did a chapter on first spouses and what it's going to mean when we get our first partner who is male, right? And now we have that. And I think, Lily, surprising about that chapter is they anticipated that there wouldn't be much pushback, depending upon who held the position, that they would probably be just fine in recreating that office. And I think that's certainly what's happening so far with Doug Imhoff, that he is taking it in stride and certainly will be shifting the office, you know, of the first gentleman, hopefully at some point to be called the first partner. Wouldn't that be great? But he's shifting that office in ways that only perhaps a man holding that position can, but he's also making sure that he's highly supportive of his spouse in terms of how it appears to the public. And that is one of the arguments that was made in the chapter, that this, you know, it would be a delicate balance, but because men already, because men are seen as legitimate in basically any position they hold, that the first gentleman would be fine.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And you know, we see that he apparently taught some of his first classes just recently at Georgetown Law School, and he seems to be weathering it all right, from everything that I can tell. I wanted to return to this question also about the role of masculinity in our thinking about the presidency, because this is something that I myself have spent a lot of time thinking about and some time writing about, and I know you have the question that Karen Holt worked on sex, gender, and leadership in the executive branch is one of the topics. And of course, Meredith's chapter as well. But I wanted to ask a little bit about the office itself in terms of, you know, barriers to entry and the masculine nature of the presidency.
Well, I would start by saying that, you know, I'm not sure that a lot of people are paying attention to what a big deal it is that there's finally a woman in the position of Secretary of the Treasury, because, you know, part of those four inner branch positions in the cabinet, Treasury being one of them, it's significant that a woman has finally broken through there, because, you know, we've had women attorney generals, and, you know, the next big thing will be a woman as defense secretary. And we've had a woman Secretary of State also. So having, you know, an experienced woman, someone who is a former Fed chair in that position, I think is important in terms of the knowledge and experience she brings to the position. But just symbolically, that is a powerful position. The economy is such an important issue right now. I mean, it always is, even when, you know, the economy is relatively good. But certainly it's one that is getting a lot of attention right now for good reason. And so I think that, you know, the small progress we can make in areas like that are significant, because for someone, you know, like me, who studies the presidency and who's been looking at, you know, these numbers for women in the cabinet over the last 30, 40 years, I mean, it's time to make much more progress in that. And I think that with the Biden administration, we're seeing a big push in that direction. And I think it's important.
I would add to that early on when we were studying the presidency and women in the presidency, a lot of the research was coming from lower offices, and I think it took the field a bit to discover that executive offices are different from legislative offices and lower level offices. And the office of the presidency actually is really difficult to predict or determine what's going to happen with a female candidate, especially, you know, if you're looking at it intersectionally, for example, you know, female candidates of color, because it is such a unique position. And we write in the book about how, the office of the presidency is really the prototypical citizen, right? And when you ask most Americans who the prototypical citizen is, it's a white male. He's male and he is white. And so the further you get away from notions of the prototypical citizen, the less legitimate you are as a candidate. And in fact, I would argue, based upon analysis of Barack Obama's presidency, the less legitimate you are in that position, and so are seen as less legitimate. And I think it's an underlying bias that we don't talk enough about. But the office is uniquely masculinized because it's seen as, you know, the titular leader of the free world. And we know that we think of leadership in very masculinized male terms. And so having that office be the epitome of leadership and be the prototypical citizen and have those, you know, have it be so heavily aligned with both of those dimensions means that it's really difficult to imagine a woman who can get into that office and not be held to just an impossible double standard. And we talk about this as, you know, the kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't, that in order to be seen as properly masculine for the presidency, because the requirements for masculine leadership are so high, that a woman would have to immediately violate gender norms, right? So it would be held against her that she wasn't feminine enough. And we see this with Sarah Palin, we see this with Hillary Clinton, the ways in which they are beaten up in, you know, profoundly gendered ways. We know that women for this office are held to different standards, and the moment a woman of color gets close to that office, we will see an intersectional race gender bias that has everything to do with how we think of the prototypical citizen and how we think of leadership.
And so we have recently elected somebody who sort of embodies the prototypical citizen in Joe Biden. But we do have, as you both have noted, and as we've all sort of taken in over the last week or two in particular, that the vice president is now being embodied by a woman who is both Black and South Asian. So in terms of the scholarship on this, where is Kamala Harris going to take our imagining of that office?
Well, I'll start by saying I think, you know, my Freudian slip probably came from the fact that a lot of people recently have asked me, so, okay, we have our first woman vice president. When are we going to get our first woman president? And my response, I'm very, you know, pragmatic about things. I said, well, you know, there's a chance we already elected our first woman president, because we also elected in Joe Biden the oldest president ever. So, you know, whether she would succeed to the office or whether she will be the heir apparent going into 2024 if Joe Biden does not run for a second term, I mean, it really greatly increases her odds of becoming president. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of pressure on her to, you know, already be trying out for the job in a lot of different ways. And, you know, the advantage that she has is that she's a skilled politician. She's good in that sense, but she doesn't have a lot of experience because she hadn't been in the Senate that long. So she really has to, you know, if we want someone in the office, which a lot of Americans did this time in terms of Joe Biden and his experience, then she does have some catching up to do and learning on the job day to day. And I think the biggest challenge for her is to show the American public that if the time comes that she could step into the role. I mean, every vice president has that pressure, but I think that she does even more so right now.
I think Lori brings up a great point that I think we all expect, whoever we is, the experts, expect that that Joe Biden is, because he said so, that he is paving the way for her leadership, whether that means he steps aside before the end of his term, whether or not that means he throws his considerable weight behind her. But I think it's important to note that when folks were thinking about electability, they kept going back to Joe Biden and even Pete Buttigieg, right? They kept going back to the white men. And there's a reason that is the case. We know that there is a price to be paid, a penalty for being a candidate of color and running for the office. And there's a penalty for being a woman and running for the office. And in a year like 2020, I think there were a lot of Democrats who were, we know from from exit polls and research since, they were concerned about, you know, about electability. In fact, prioritize electability over other substantive issues. And just to point out, to reiterate, when we think of electability, we think of white men who don't have to pay that penalty. And I think that we saw the penalty that Kamala Harris pays as a woman of color during the primary. I recently did a piece for the American Sociological Association that unpacked how she was framed and how she was talked about during the primary and then into the general election. And the thing that struck me, I think the moment that struck me the most about the double standard was the vice presidential debate and how her demeanor had to be, you know, she was very carefully not tripping the stereotype of the angry Black woman, but she also, you know, couldn't be seen as, you know, the gender stereotypes of being, you know, less independent or being submissive. So she had some very fine lines to walk, and she walked them. It was noted that she smiled a lot and, you know, was very gracious in her remarks. And I just, in that moment, imagine Mike Pence smiling as much as Kamala Harris did during that debate. It would seem strange and it would seem absurd. And I think that moment really highlighted the challenges that are unique to being a woman of color and running even close to the presidency.
And the book itself, you know, talks about barriers that we think exist, barriers that we once had that existed, but are perhaps not as much of a barrier anymore, like money raising, fundraising. Can you briefly sort of summarize what the barriers are that most people think exist for women running for president? And what are the barriers that exist, given the research that you both have done and what's in the book itself?
I think that, yeah, there are some barriers that people think still exist that don't, but I think that there are some barriers that get overlooked. And I think one of the most important things for me, and this is hard to quantify, but it's just that the lack of women in higher office, whether it's gubernatorial positions or, you know, prominent leadership positions within the federal government, I think that has just fed into the idea for a lot of people that, you know, women aren't in these positions. There aren't enough to really look at in a candidate pool when you get into the election. And so I think that the changes coming with a woman vice president and more prominent women and throughout the executive branch, or even just how many, you know, White House correspondents now for major news organizations are women. I mean, just seeing more women in these positions, I think will make a difference, whether hopefully more than symbolically, but I think it will help move this along in terms of, yeah, of course a woman can get elected to any of these positions.
I would say that the barriers that don't exist are generally structural, in the sense that the political parties, if you're running for the presidency and really are a legitimate contender, you will likely be able to gather the resources that you need. The party will be behind you, as well as a lot of major donors. And I know that's kind of part of getting that far. But once you get into that echelon, it's a pretty even playing field in terms of resources. I think the double standards that still exist are that scandals fall differently for women candidates. So, for example, you know, Hillary Clinton's husband's sexual scandals, which, you know, I think he's got, I would deem them sexual violence, but setting that, you know, not setting that aside to dismiss it, but setting it aside because it's not Hillary Clinton, her husband's sexual violence or allegations of sexual violence were held against her more than Donald Trump's actual allegations of sexual violence, right? And so scandals fall differently. Hillary Clinton getting as much scandal coverage, for example, as Donald Trump during the 2016 election is kind of remarkable given the difference in terms of fodder for scandals. And the dress and appearance that women still have to, are still held to Hillary Clinton talked about this, I believe in her 2008 bid, where she said, I have to wake up an hour earlier. It's certainly the case, right, where women's dress and appearance matters a lot more to voters in ways that I think they're not necessarily aware of. And the moment at which a candidate is sexualized or, you know, is a female candidate is too attractive, it's held against her. We view her as less competent. And in the case of Sarah Palin, with a one experiment that was done, we care less about her as a person. We dehumanize women who are sexualized. So I think the double standard of having to be physically attractive in order to be seen as a legitimate candidate, and then having that held against you is an issue. And then the double standard of leadership, you know, the where you're damned if you do and damned if you don't in terms of being properly masculine and properly feminine. And these are all pretty big barriers when you think about the fact that they're amorphous, but they very much influence how a candidate is perceived. And it's not like a voter is going to say, oh, I don't like her because of X. They're just going to say, you know, she doesn't do it for me.
And in this regard, also along with those barriers, is there a breakdown across party lines with regard to some of these sort of more amorphous barriers that you've found in your own research?
Well, I think the numbers show certainly that the Republican Party is really lagging behind in terms of electing women. You know, they had a little bit of progress in 2018 and 2020, but there's a stark difference between the percentages, the number of women on the Democratic side, the number of women on the Republican side, and I think that needs to be addressed. I mean, a couple of the most prominent women in the Republican Party, I would say, you know, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins are, you know, marginalized within their own party because they are more moderate, they're more reasonable, they don't always follow the party line, and they certainly weren't always in line with the Trump presidency. So I think that is a bigger burden on the Republican side right now to find a place within that party. So I think there's definitely work that needs to be done.
And in general, Lily, we know there's a party difference in terms of the folks who are upset or afraid of a woman being in the White House. And, you know, we get around this in lots of tricky ways as political scientists because folks won't actually say that they won't admit this bias. But it's about 15% for Republicans, and it's about 8% for Democrats, which is a sizable chunk of the population. And this is, of course, not an actual candidate, but rather a generic candidate. But the bias is pretty high in both parties. And I think the most telling data that came out of the 2020 election, where you have the more female candidates in the Democratic primary than at any point in history. And we know that the more different types of sexism, whether it was traditional sexism or modern sexism that a Democratic voter held, that the less support they had for a woman candidate. So it's certainly partisan in that Republicans tend to have more bias, slightly more bias against a female president. But the numbers in both parties are, I would say, remarkably high.
And so now that we have Kamala Harris, and now that we have had a standard bearer in a woman of Hillary Clinton in 2016, I want to know what the two of you are working on to help us understand the terrain and the politics of a woman as president.
Well, I can tell you that, so I have a textbook on the presidency with my co-author Diane Heath with Oxford University Press, and we are just starting work on a third edition of that. And one of the things that we are doing is because one, it will help market the book, but two, because it's important and we should be doing it regardless, is really going through and adding elements of much more in terms of gender and race, ethnicity throughout the text. And I think that from a textbook standpoint, it's really important for us to get, you know, students thinking about these questions, the things that we've been studying all of these years. And, you know, I'm really hoping that with Kamala Harris as vice president and, you know, all of the progress that is being made, that we just start to normalize the idea of women in positions of political power more so than before. You know, thinking about where we're at in 2021 with this question, I guess I feel optimistic and frustrated at the same time that, you know, wow, we have a woman vice president and all of these women going into these really powerful positions across the board. And then I think, wow, it's 2021. It took this long, really? It seems like we've been talking about this forever. And for, you know, for my career, I feel like we have. And I think that it's really time we make a little bit more progress. And I'd like to see it on both sides of the aisle too, because I think that having a diversity of experience as women will really, you know, make a difference in terms of governing and policymaking in this country.
And Lily, I'm working on a book called Intersectionality and the Presidency that looks at how conceptions of the prototypical citizen and race, gender, sexuality, age, disability, and body size have influenced the presidency, both in terms of candidates and leadership. And it's, I think, long overdue to be looking at how who we think is appropriate to hold the office of the presidency is really a reflection of democratic values and a limitation on democratic values. So for example, you know, the bias against women and bias against people of color and the price that you pay if you're a woman of color running for that office means that, you know, it's not really a democratic office, and what that means for the American psyche, what that tells us about how we think about democracy and inclusion in politics and participation. So I'm about halfway through that book, and the 2020 election has been incredibly rich in terms of analysis because of the sheer diversity and variety of candidates who ran on the Democratic side.
Well, I look forward to speaking with both of you when these books come out, including the textbook, Lori, when you and Diane finish the third edition.
Sure.
And I'm delighted to speak with you today about Madam President? Gender and Politics on the Road to the White House. Thank you, Caroline Heldman and Lori Cox-Hahn, for joining me today on the New Books Network. And I'm wondering where somebody can pick up a copy of this book. I assume it's available at the Lynn Reiner website. Are there any brick and mortar stores with some, you know, sort of virtual portals that you would like to give a shout out to?
Caroline?
I'm thinking during the pandemic,
yeah.
You know, your local bookstore, if you can possibly support them, either we'll have, you know, a copy that's easy for delivery. I won't even say the name of the big retailer that
that's
I'm trying to not mention.
That's fine.
Yeah. Well, we're both in Southern California, so everything's been, you know, so shut down here that hopefully there's something that out there that were, you know, an alternate to that big name retailer where you could go find this book.
Thank you both for joining me today.
Thanks, Lily.
Thank you, Lily.
It's my pleasure.